Sermons from the Journey is the audio podcast of the weekly message preached by Reverend Becca Gorell, pastor at Lebanon United Methodist Church in Lebanon, New Hampshire, and blogging at pastorbecca.com. Thanks for listening.
I didn't fiddle with the lectionary at all. That story that introduces Rebecca is one of the recommended readings for today when I introduce myself. So I thought maybe someone was trying to give me an opportunity here. In this passage, we meet the biblical figure of Rebecca. And as I said, as I was preparing to read the passage, her son, Jacob, later changes his name to Israel and becomes the father of all of the tribes of Israel, right? So Rebecca is really the grandmother of all of the tribes of Israel, a very important matriarch and figure in the lineage of the Hebrew Bible, and therefore not only in the story of just the tribes of Israel, but the whole of the Jewish faith, the Christian faith, and is connected into through her in-laws and that immediate generation through the founding stories of the faith of Islam as well. And so a very important, magnificent kind of figure in the Bible and in history that we get to meet this morning in this passage. She is recognized, what I love in this passage, she's recognized first by this kind of act of compassion that she does, right? The servant is kind of looking for a sign and sort of sets up, I wish we could do that, sets up the sign that he'd like God to give him and says, if this happens, then I'll know. That's not the way it usually works for me, but I'm glad it works for him. But he says, you know, if this happens, then I'll know that this is the woman that is meant for Abraham's son, for Isaac. And he's gone to this foreign land because it's really a step home for his master's family, back to their homeland and the people that are kin to them, to find someone for Isaac to marry. Of course, this is a very different time and place, so he's been sent to literally just pluck a woman up and escort her away to meet and marry Isaac. But he seeks out a young woman from this sort of act of compassion, that she's going to show her compassion for him and for his camels as well. A person who has compassion for all living things, right? And is not just going to draw water for a single person, which I imagine, you know, is a portion of her jug, but for all of his camels. He's come with quite an entourage, so that's a lot of camels. That's a lot of dips into the well to pull the jug up again and again and again and water all of those camels. An act of love, of hospitality, of compassion, and that's how she's recognized as the person who's going to be part of this family. And then he goes to her family's house, and he shares this story with them because, of course, again, different time and place. It's really her parents, it's really her father, let's be clear, who's going to give her away, to allow for this marriage to be arranged. But what I love about the story is that they say, even then, that they call to her and they ask her, will you go with this man? They do give her some choice. Which I think is a powerful and kind of subversive thing for that time and place. They ask the woman if she's willing. This is a strange story the servant is spinning about how God has called him and has revealed to him that she is the one to come to this place. It's kind of like when the cabinet says, God has called to us and revealed to us that you are the one to come to this place. So they have at least the kindness to ask her, are you willing to go? The cabinet does too. I'm not saying they don't. And she says yes. She says, yes, I'll do that. That sounds great. Or that sounds okay. Or yeah. She buys that story. She gets into it. She believes, I think. She believes his story, that this is what God is calling them to do. And so she says, yes, I will go with this man. And she gathers her household with her, and she mounts the camels, and off they go for who knows how long. And from far away, she sees the man who will be her husband, never having seen him before, and kind of likes to look at him. Hey, who's that guy? And he sees her and welcomes her and brings her into his home, into his parents' home, into, we're told very specifically, his mother's home. And she becomes his wife, and we're told he loves her and he is comforted after his mother's death by her presence. Her very presence in his life is a soothing balm to him after the loss of his mother and after what, reading a little into it here, but I'm imagining is a little bit of a tenuous relationship with his dad. It's hard to have a really close relationship with a parent who tries to sacrifice you when you're a kid. So things can't have been easy for Isaac growing up. I think his mom was his rock and he's lost her. And Rebecca becomes his healing and his balm. Now here, this matriarch, she's doing really well in this story so far, right? If we stopped right there, we would say, what a person of faith to be admired. And we would say, we have someone we can look up to. It's a simple story, it's a beautiful story, it's a great introduction. There's much that we can admire about her, her compassion, her decision to follow a call, her courage, her soothing, gentle heart that eases pain after loss. But don't we all want to be like that? Life gets a little bit more complex for Rebecca after that. She has kids. That's one of the ways life gets complex. It happens for a lot of people. She gives birth to twin sons, and they are both her delight and her incredible struggle. They're always at each other's throats. They're always competing for their parents' affection and attention, and competing for all sorts of random things, it seems. Her eldest son, you know, that's the one that's supposed to inherit the family fortune such as it is and the blessing and the lineage of the people, right? Her eldest son is a bit rough around the edges. Esau, he's a little bit boorish. He's a little bit ungrateful or disrespectful of the privilege that has been given him as the eldest son in this family, in this place. He's so blasé about it that he trades his birthright away to his brother one day because there's a good-smelling pot of lentil soup he wants. Now, everybody likes a good-smelling pot of lentil soup, but he trades away his inheritance for it in this short-sighted moment. On the other hand, Jacob, he's no saint either, although, well, we might later call him one. He's no perfect paragon of virtue either. Unlike his brother, he sees the big, long-range picture, and so he is willing to sit back and play the strategy game for years, whether it's for his birthright, or for a wife or more, or for flocks and flocks and flocks of livestock that he's using some sort of sneaky breeding method to make sure he gets the most of. He's a very shrewd and brilliant, but bit on that edge kind of guy. Poor Rebecca, her sons are by no means perfect. Of course, she's by no means perfect. And so in this pivotal moment, in the history of these faiths, of these nations, that's all kind of woven together as we look back at this family and how their drama becomes part of the drama of the whole story of our faith, of the Jewish faith, of that part of the world. As we look back, there's this pivotal moment. Which of these sons, neither of whom is perfect, is going to receive his father's blessing and become the patriarch from whom the nations come? And Jacob and Rebecca decide that it's going to be Jacob. And so as Isaac, this husband that she has loved and who has loved her, as Isaac is ailing and aging and dying, and his eyesight and his hearing are so deteriorated that he can't really tell one person from another, Rebecca conspires with her younger son against her older son and her husband and, I don't know, the entire patriarchal lineage tradition to make sure that Jacob is the one who receives the blessing. They dress Jacob in the clothing and attire of his hairier, bigger brother, and they send him into Isaac's room to receive that blessing, which, of course, he does. Is she following God's call again? What she believes is right, what she and Jacob together think is the destiny of their people, and it turns out for the record that they're right? Perhaps. It's an act that shapes the entire nation that comes after. An act that shapes not just a family, but tribes upon tribes. An act that shapes the lineage that we trace down to Jesus. An act that shapes us. But an act that at the time is read as betrayal, as dishonesty, as manipulation. Maybe because it's a woman and a younger child doing it, people who are not supposed to take their own power. And we're told for this act that when Jacob leaves the house with his father's blessing, like a mantle around his shoulders, and the flocks and the inheritance and all that he has, and sets out to make his fortune, that Rebekah never sees him again. We're told very specifically that that is punishment for their action, that they do not see each other again. There is loss. There is brokenness. There is deep pain in this story. In this matriarch, in this person, this paragon of faith, there is also deep loss and sorrow and alienation and brokenness. She is not perfect. Her life is not perfect. There is beauty and love and joy, and there is pain and sorrow and manipulation and loss. Life is like that. Such a powerful, powerful story wrapped around this one person, this one remarkable person, who yet in all the flawed narrative is so remarkably human, so like us. There's, of course, no way my parents could have known my whole personality or my life story when they named me, although maybe they had some inkling. I'd like to think that I'm a person known, recognized for my compassion. Not just for one person, but for all living things. I'd like to think that about myself. I'd like to think that I'm a person of courage and a person who hears the call of God, whether within myself or articulated at someone else, that someone else has discerned and shared with me, who hears that and who says, yeah, I can do that. Yes, I'll go. Here I am, send me. I'd like to think that about myself. I'd like to think that I'm a person who can be a comfort to others in a time of loss or sadness or broken and estranged relationships. I'd like to think that about myself. I'm less excited to think of myself as conniving or manipulative, though we all have a little bit of that in us sometimes. I can be incredibly strategic to see the long picture, to be stubborn and hold out and, you know, see the big scheme of things. Jacob got it from somewhere. And I do like a good pot of lentil stew. Esau got it from somewhere. And I have most certainly been known to follow my heart, to do what I think is right and good, even and especially when that means justice or inclusivity or a righting of wrongs for those pushed to the margins, for those disempowered by society and cast aside, and to do what I feel and discern and feel in my gut is right. And sometimes that flies in the face of some established systems here and there. I've been known to do that for sure. And I've known pain and loss and brokenness, as we all have. Life is not always being praised for our compassion and our bravery and our courage and our kindness. It's not always being given rings for our noses and our arms and gold bracelets, receiving marriage proposals from afar, being seen from across a field. Life is also loss and hardship and separation and sorrow, all woven together in this story. I share a lot with Rebekah, not just our names, but I imagine that so do you. And we share a lot with other people as well. I can see parts of myself in David or Jeremiah, in Moses or in Miriam. I can see parts of myself in John or in Mary or in Joseph or in another Mary or in Martha or in another Mary. The Bible is full of these characters, these people who are real and visceral. They're none of them perfect. Although we would later name some of them saints, they are none of them cut out to be picture-perfect examples. But they are real and human. They make mistakes. They are broken. They have issues, lots and lots of family system issues. And God works in their lives, each and every one. God works in and through their lives. And what I love about every one of those stories and those moments when I feel a connection with them, what I love about every one of them is that it's a reminder to me in whom the magnificent and the mundane are woven together, in whom the beautiful and the praiseworthy and the little rough around the edges, a little questionable are woven together. That if God can use them, then God can use me. If God can work in those people, in those circumstances, in those stories, then God works in us too. And that is perhaps the biggest thing I share with the woman for whom I was named. This kind of magnificent figure in all of her beauty and brokenness is that she is a reminder to me that God works in the most remarkable places, that God works in the magnificent and broken woven together, that God works in my life. And I hope that my life is a reminder to others, and I hope that your life is a reminder to others that God works in the most magnificent places, not because we are perfect, but because we are imperfect, because we are just like the saints and sinners, who are not separate people, but the same people, who fill the Bible with their stories, who fill our history with their stories, whose lives touch our own and mirror our own. If God can work, does work, did work in and through them, then God can and did and does work in and through us, in you and me, and in us together. I'm excited to see what God is going to do with the magnificent and mundaneness of who we are together, of who each of us is, of this relationship of church as we come together in this configuration. What will God do in us and through us? I can't wait to see. Amen.